Hi, this is Marcia from Montgomery Creek. You're listening to KKRN Bella Vista, located in Round Mountain. Thank you for listening.
Programming on KKRN Community Radio is sponsored in part by listeners like you and New West Medical. New West Medical's goal is for their patients to live the most active and fulfilling lives possible. They provide oxygen services, sleep therapy, power mobility, and medical equipment. They are locally owned and are located at 2971 Churn Creek Road in Reading. Phone number is 221-5864. New West Medical, living, breathing solutions. KKRN thanks New West Medical for their support.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the host, the guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises, or underwriters of this station.
Welcome to our show, Examine Life, on KKRN at 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain.
I'm Steve.
And I'm Pat.
Plato and Socrates both said that the unexamined life is not worth living. Plato really said it because of what happened to Socrates. But on our program, we examine different aspects of human life. And tonight,
we're going to examine the aspects of the mind. A little bit about attitude, perspective, and things that relate to that.
Our next few programs, we'll be talking about the human mind and the brain along with that. We're talking about primarily your attitude tonight, and we kind of had a discussion off the air about what the word attitude means, and of course it depends on where you're from, but the textbook the Oxford definition of attitude is a settled way of thinking or feeling about someone or something, typically one that is reflected in a person's behavior. The textbook definition by psychologists is that it's the enduring and global evaluation of a person, an object, or an issue, which can include your evaluations of people, issues, objects, or events, often positive or negative, but they can be uncertain at times. You might have mixed feelings about a person or an issue. They don't usually change, but they can, and they're usually based on things like your thoughts and beliefs about the subject, the affective component, which is how the person or issue affects you, or the behavioral component, how the attitude influences your behavior. And how do they form? There's a lot of different factors on how they form, and we'll be talking about some of that tonight. One is memes, which we'll talk about later in the program.
You described thoughts and beliefs about a subject, and I do believe that thinking is what we're all about. It's what dominates our mind, and it's conscious or subconsciously. Attitude might be a conscious thinking, and perspective might be a subconscious thinking, you might describe it as. And what we think is just like what we eat, we are. What we think is what we are. It's how we see the world. It creates our mindset. Those thoughts create our attitude and our perspective, and we can change them. We can edit them.
We can change our attitudes. It just takes a little bit of effort. There are different methods of that. A very interesting book that was written in the 60s called Psycho-Cybernetics. You might want to look it up. I forget the author, but it talks about how you can use your conscious mind to program your unconscious mind so that it influences your conscious mind in the future.
And it's called focused attention. Now we refer to it as focused attention, where we edit our thoughts in order to control them and our perspective on life.
And back in the days of that book, he wrote it, he wanted you to imagine yourself being the person you wanted to become. So he called it creative imagination, which was basically different views of the same thing.
We're all on the road of life with all the pitfalls of traveling. Your destination is your dream, what you want out of life. But the road of life has potholes, detours, floods, and sometimes we have to make a U-turn or make a choice at the fork in the road.
And many times people don't have realistic dreams or don't even bother to really have a dream. They just kind of go through day by day. And then they're surprised at the outcome or, you know, miffed or whatever. you need to take an interest and actually have a dream. Sit down and think quietly. What is my dream? What do I want? And it doesn't have to be the big end-of-life dream. It can be the dream for next week.
And you can simply make goals for each year, say. If you write them, they've proven, if you write them down and reread them every month, chances are you will achieve 60 to 70% of those goals just because you are consciously implanting them in your subconscious.
The idea behind the psycho-cybernetics was that you visualize yourself being the person you want to be, and without any effort, you just kind of automatically become that person if you repeatedly visualize that enough and visualize it in the right way.
Wayne Dyer, who was a psychologist, wrote a number of books and tapes on being successful and achieving what you want out of life. And it was basically making you realize you can control your life with your thoughts. You can change your life by the way you think. He recently died, but he promoted the power of positive thinking and forgiveness. And a famous quote I want to read to you, it says, "How people treat you is their karma. How you react is yours." Says a lot if you think about it.
Yeah, and that word karma is being used a lot more nowadays, even by people of a Christian bent.
Yeah, well, it's a spiritual term, I think, that people don't like to accept.
It depends on the Buddhist or the Hindu that you talk to. To some of them, it's a spiritual thing. To some of them, it's kind of a law of the universe that every action has an equal and opposite reaction, kind of like one of Newton's laws.
And when we see someone who's done something bad and we have no control over it, we often refer to, well, you know, karma, what goes around comes around kind of attitude.
Right.
Our frustration.
Because you can't really point to a scientific cause, but actually, generally, things always do come around again. It's just it's a reality, but it doesn't have any scientific basis.
And on that road to life that we are all on, if there's a detour, sometimes we find that as an accident or trauma in our lives. And we have to get back on that road at some point and continue with our life. And that is usually the biggest challenges that we have, is those detours or unexpected events. But every setback can be a challenge that becomes a silver lining.
It's funny, the people I've met in the last 40 years being in different medical venues, I don't know what the word disability really means, because I know lots of people that are unable to use major parts of their body that accomplish a lot in life. And I don't just mean, you know, going to school or creating art, but I mean people who actually support themselves, create a business or do some incredible feats, which renders the word disabled kind of a mixed bag.
I was once told attitude is everything, and I have that on my wall at the office so that if I get upset or something about something or someone, I always remember that attitude colors my life. There was a saying, don't let any man make your day, and that goes back to you create your own reality. Don't let that bad event from that guy on the phone
Or gal,
make you feel angry for the rest of the day or hostile. Don't let them have that power over you. Take back. You're in control of your response to them.
Right. The sentence, you made me angry, is an oxymoron. No one can make you angry. People can do things to try to cause you to be angry, but you'll be the one that's being angry, not them.
And it is your response to whatever they did. And you are in control of your responses. That is part of your perspective on life. If you have a hostile perspective, then you're going to immediately become angry. If you have a more positive approach to life, I know there are people that won't sue anybody or won't go after anybody for something that they feel that they have been harmed. Their attitude is, I don't want to waste my energy chasing that negativity of 2 years in court or whatever it might be, when I could be living more positive, more enriched life.
True. And a lot of it has to do with if we're being true to ourselves. Many times people will do a lawsuit or something like that, and they'll say, oh, I'm doing it so that no one else will get harmed. But if they look in their heart of hearts, it's about the money. You know, it's being honest with ourselves is a rare occurrence, but it's one that can truly make you happy.
Yes. And back to that road of life and those detours and accidents and trauma, they a setback can cause you to stop living. That traumatic event will be so traumatic that you can't go forward with your life. In those cases, you really need help. You need a professional to help you through that. If you become paralyzed by fear or whatever it is that emotionally you cannot go forward, that's the kind of trauma that I'm talking about, is the emotional perspective of I can't go on living or I can't do this anymore or whatever. That's when you really need to talk to somebody, even if it's a relative that you trust. Those kinds of traumatic events need outside influence. You need to get them out of your head so where you can see them.
But it helps to have a good perspective to realize that whatever the situation is that in your case is just paralyzing you, to realize that it's guaranteed that someone else has gone through that and made it a positive experience. And what that tells you is that the experience itself has no power. The power is all yours.
And life is setbacks, challenges, and obstacles. Sometimes we think that it's more than we can bear. And there's been many books written about overcoming what appeared to be insurmountable odds. There's a recent one out, Travis Mills. He's a quadriplegic, and one of only five that have survived the Iraqi and Afghanistan wars. And he's written a book called As Tough As They Come. I have not yet read it. I hear it just came out like last week. But here is a man that has overcome insurmountable challenges of losing both arms and legs. This is something that is not only traumatic, but this is change of lifetime of things. And his perspective, his attitude towards life and living, he's only 25 years old. His whole life has been altered. And yet he has this incredible attitude. They had him on television and talking to him very briefly, but he was so upbeat. It was absolutely incredible.
And remember that your attitude is, at least the textbook version of it, is that it's an evaluation. And so when something happens to you, you evaluate what has happened and you evaluate what you think can be done about it. And you do that and you realize that it's happened to someone else and they found a way through it in a positive way. And none of us is perfect, but just understand that every situation someone else has lived through.
And I've had a couple of friends in the last year or so diagnosed with cancer, and one terminally, and they're going through chemo and radiation. And their oncologist told them, your attitude is everything. It'll determine how long you live. If you are surrendering to the disease or if you're going to fight it, makes a big difference in the outcome.
And there are cancer centers now that are, their program is based upon those principles. So there has to be some validity there, because they can't maintain their operations and stay open if what they're doing is not valid.
Right.
It doesn't work for people. So it does work for people.
And what you think, and this is your conscious thoughts about your relationships, your family, love, school, your job, whatever it is in life, determines how you behave and how you respond to others based on your perspective of them. So if you think someone dislikes you, you approach them with the negative thought, that person doesn't like me, or I don't like that person. And you will communicate with them differently than you talk to somebody who is a friend whom you like or admire.
Right. There's no harm in approaching somebody. I mean, if you fear for your life, that's a different scenario. You need to act accordingly if your fear is valid. Of course, many fears aren't valid. And actually, decisions made in fear generally turned out wrong. Caution is one thing. Fear can lead you to caution. But when you make a decision out of pure fear, it's generally going to be the wrong decision.
And fear drives a lot of us. It is our oldest emotion, and it's hard to get past that sometimes. And oftentimes we take fear and we disguise it as something else. This is, happens a lot in personal relationships, either a friend or your spouse. You decide, you start thinking negative thoughts about that relationship. They're not treating me equally, or they're not treating me the way I want to be treated, and I feel slighted in some way. And so instead of them dumping me, I'm going to do something ahead of schedule so that I don't get rejected. I have this fear of rejection, but we color it based on our thoughts, what we're thinking at that time.
Sure. And we don't seem to modify those thoughts at all, or people don't seem to want to modify them and really have an open discussion with each other, you know, from this Mars and Venus perspective. You know, understand that we're coming from different biological and genetic foundations, and try to understand that other person, that they are coming from a different place. If both of you are doing that, it can only be a positive outcome.
And if you have respect for that other person and you have admiration for that other person, if you show it, you will get a positive response. It is just human nature. We respond positively to people that tell us nice things about us, or we're treated in a positive manner. We will respond the same way. If you have a negative perspective of that person, then that's, chances are, the kind of response you're going to get from them.
Often we make assumptions about what they think about us.
That are wrong.
Yeah, that aren't really. It's because of our own picture of maybe how we think people should think of us. And everyone has positive things to contribute.
Yes, and we all have positive images of some people, and they may change based on how they treat us. This is why relationships fall apart. We no longer have an appreciation or admiration of somebody, and it starts showing in our actions and how we treat them. And they pull away, or we pull away. And that causes a big communication gap.
Part of the concept of examining life is to deeply examine your own reactions to life. And that's essentially what examine life means. It doesn't mean always be looking around you at everything, but looking inside at your reactions and your assumptions and validating them. Is what I'm thinking real? Is what I'm thinking productive? Check yourself. A lot of people don't want to do that. I think it's an ego thing myself. You know, if I have something to fix, then I must be flawed, when in fact we all have something to fix. So check yourself. Is what you're thinking rational?
And your thinking, again, is only your perspective. Have you validated that through communication with that other person? You might be head over heels in love with somebody, but they're not in love with you. It happens all the time with, you hear about people that, what do they talk, that first rejection in life, or that first love affair as a teenager where you're in love and they're not, and it's a reality check, and then from then on you're never going to fall in love. Okay, these stories are abundant in movies. This is, again, we need to check our perspective. We need to edit our thoughts. And it can be about anything. It can be about our children. If we have negative thoughts about our children, even though they might be adults, then they will feel that. They'll respond to that in a negative way. They'll pull away, or you'll back away. And that's where you need to examine and edit your thoughts. You need to examine and edit your speech to one another. If you have negative thoughts and you make harmful remarks, you might think you're helping somebody by telling them they're fat, but is that really helping them to browbeat them or injure them with words, where you might have a more positive approach and get a positive outcome?
Or not say anything at all.
Yeah, do these pants make me look fat?
Yeah, yeah, that's one thing you want to shy away from, or gird yourselves with armor.
I said edit.
Yeah. I know that people have mentioned that on this program, you know, I can say something with sarcasm and sound mean. So how you say something, you have to realize that other people take it a certain way. And sometimes something you didn't intend to be the wrong way, other people will interpret what your emotions were behind it. And I'm guilty of that myself quite a bit. probably why I'm pursuing a psychology degree, is I'm always assuming what other people's emotions are behind what they're saying, which gets me in a lot of trouble.
Well, we're all take for granted to some extent words we argue about, you might say, because I interpret it as one way and you intended it as another. And we've had this argument over words specific.
We do it all the time. And one of them tonight was the discussion of what is attitude. That's why I gave the textbook and definitive definition of it, because it means different things to different people. Attitude in New York means something different than attitude in Jersey than attitude in the Midwest.
And what my definition of attitude is different than what Steve's definition is attitude. And that's okay. We're both coming from a different perspective. We both have different life experiences. And so our outlook on life is different.
But understand that when you're talking to someone and you say a word, if you don't have the same definition of that word, there's going to be an argument, because you're assuming that they're hearing what you're saying, but they're not. They're hearing what their definition of the word tells them.
And think about this when the next time you go to the doctor and you've gained a little weight and he goes, your problem is because you're fat. He's looking at a person, not the person on the inside. He's looking at a physical shape that he feels is not acceptable to his standards or medical standards. So he's criticizing your physical being. Well, when you talk to somebody, your family or a friend, and you tell them they're fat, that's an insult, because you know them as a person and they expect you to respond to them as a person, not as your physical being. When we're in love, we don't see that person. What is that, rose-colored glasses? We see through rose-colored glasses.
Oh, and everyone's on best behavior to boot for goodness knows how long in the relationship before they start showing their true colors.
So love is that perspective of, I don't really see your flaws. I see the wonderfulness of you. And that's how we want to be treated by family and our spouse.
And when we say things, people interpret it their own way. You know, if you're working with a mathematician and you're in school, and they say you can't figure out this particular problem because you haven't had the material yet, and the professor, who happens to be someone who's very much into precise language, says, well, you're ignorant. Most people will take that as a very negative thing, but all ignorant means is you didn't know that.
Yes.
But when I say it, trying to be logical, it sounds like I'm beating you up, and I'm really not. I'm just stating the situation as it stands. You didn't get taught that, so you're ignorant of it.
But the average interpretation of that is an insult, because it has negative connotations. So your speech to me might not be intended to be negative, but my perception of the word makes it a negative statement.
And so I should be attentive to the fact that you may not interpret it the same way, and you should be attentive to the same thing. With both parties being that way, we can avoid a lot of conflict.
Yes. And that's where if my response is a negative response, you might know me well enough to pick up on that, or I might say, did you intend that to be an insult?
Right. And that's a good, when you feel really insulted, ask them if they intended that to be an insult. For one thing, it kind of takes some of the emotion out of it when you put it that way.
And it clears the air to some extent. Think about it. Examine what you've said to somebody if they turn away, or if their face implies a hurtfulness. It's your responsibility maybe to step up and say, that's not how I intended you to receive that information.
Unless they just have gas.
Or you did intend it to be received that way. Your negative speech is as harmful as negative actions.
Sure.
If not worse.
Well, yeah. So you had mentioned before a specific movie you wanted to talk about when we're dealing with children, for instance.
In the journal Psychology Science, they suggest that validating a scary emotional experience strips the incident of its power and allows the negative feelings to dissipate more quickly. And it's like saying, I'm afraid of X. And the movie Monsters, Inc. dealt with this beautifully, with the fears of kids about creatures in the closet or under the bed at night, something like that. It was a great movie. It allowed children to see the boogeyman as a big, furry, funny guy, or somebody was not threatening. And this, to me, is fabulous. I love these kind of movies for kids because kids are so easily adjusted in their thinking when they're little.
Well, and I think a part of this article is what's trying to say is instead of telling your children, don't be afraid, that makes them bottle up these fears. Let them be afraid, but then discuss that with them. And that's how you bring in light to things is how you fix them.
Yeah, let your child tell you that they're afraid. And it helps them deal with the feelings and emotions tied to that, whatever that incident was. And the, you know, guy in the closet or underneath the bed. And it might take months for you to positively reinforce them that, yes, it's okay for you to be afraid, but let's look in the closet and realize there really isn't anybody there. And
at least not tonight.
You're not supposed to say that part.
Anything is possible.
They also found that in the United Kingdom, University of Exeter found in a study that looking at pictures of people caring for one another or pets reduces our stress response. The pictures remind us of a secure attachment or reassures us that there are people that loves us, that there's a support system, and allows us to handle those stressful conditions more easily and reduces our stress response. You know how hard it is for us to deal with stress every day and the mounting amount, the ever abundance of it in our life? These little tricks, just looking at a picture of you hugging your dog or the family vacation last year, can reduce stress instantly for you.
But, you know, there are other methods. I mean, stress is not a thing that happens to you. Stress is a reaction to things that happen to you. Because I can recite countless situations where you believe something has stressed you out, and that same exact set of circumstances will make someone else feel wonderful. Jumping off of a bridge with a bungee cord to your ankles is an example. It's horrifying to one person and exhilarating to another. That tells you that the bungee jumping is not the stressor. The reaction to it is the stressor.
Your perspective of the danger and fear from it.
Right.
And this is about everything in life. Everything we do has a different stress level for each of us. And we have a tendency to avoid stress. It's, life-sustaining thing is to stay away from stress. We know what it does to us.
Well, I remember an earlier educational experience I had related to stress back in my stress-filled early days. And an exercise they gave us before we had answering machines was to not answer the phone one day that week as a homework assignment. And I was frantic about that because I'm one of those that used to be tied to that. And what I discovered from that is that it kind of dawned on me when I was sitting there waiting for the phone to stop ringing. You know, I'm working full time. I'm going to college full time. I'm gone a lot, and this phone must ring, and yet the sky is still above me, and the world is still spinning around. And that tells me that the stress is all internal.
Not only that, but if I'm in a situation where I don't want to respond to that cell phone call or that text message that my phone is pinging to me to go and look at, I think, you know what? I'm in the bathroom. I don't have time for that right now. I'll get to it in 3 or 4 minutes, and it's perfectly fine.
My wife would say I'm not like that when it comes to my cell phone.
But think about it. It's a way of managing stress of that phone ringing and pinging.
I don't really have stress over, I don't answer the phone lots of times and don't answer texts lots of times. When I let myself get stressed is when someone else doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. You expect an immediate
That's
response.
Right.
They don't know how important you are.
That's right.
Your perspective of who you are. One other thing, we had a show a couple weeks ago about labeling, and we, as a response to someone's appearance or their behavior, we label them. And if someone's out of control, we call them stupid. If they're angry or bigoted, we call them an idiot. And it's not that we're intellectually describing them as stupid or being an idiot. They have shut down the knowledge, logical side of them, thus making them appear stupid. And so we label them that when, in fact, it's a description of their activity or their behavior.
I've had that happen to me even on this show and in personal experiences with political discussions where instead of someone giving you a logical argument, they just talk about how ignorant you must be. You know, when I talked about minimum wage to someone about how the negative sides of it, the response was, well, you must think that the Holocaust wasn't real. I mean, that's the kind of language that tells you that nothing's going to get accomplished with that person.
But it's, again, it's about the fact that the way someone is responding to us, that we label them based on a single incident rather than really their intellect.
Or not even really understanding where they're coming from, just making assumptions. That's why it's always better to discuss, like you said earlier. Ask the person, did you mean that to insult me? And you might be surprised by the answer. Maybe they did. And they might say yes. But then you know where you stand. There's, yes. Even in that situation, there'll be less strife than if you mistakenly assume that.
Okay, we're going to take a little break and leave it there, and we'll come back, and we'll talk a little bit more about children.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on, and my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this, a kiss to build a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me, and my imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part, a kiss to build a dream on.
Join the discussion. KKRN boasts a variety of talk radio, both from local and syndicated sources. We want to stimulate thoughtful and meaningful conversation. KKRN can offer more real conversation because we are supported by listeners. You have a voice.
Make them believe they're true. Oh, give me your lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live.
The infinite possibilities of music are showcased by the eclectic panorama of song styles that you can find on KKRN Radio. You won't find our musical explorations on more mainstream commercially driven stations. From classic country to new age, from classic folk to classic rock, from blues to jazz, and music from outside our country. You'll find it all on KKRN listener-supported radio, radio that makes you listen.
You're listening to Examine Life on KKRN 88.5 FM, and the views and opinions expressed on this program are of the speakers and do not reflect the views and opinions of the radio station KKRN, Acorn Community Enterprises, its management, staff, or underwriters.
So now we're going to talk a little bit about our children.
Yes.
Those little aliens.
Well, we need to encourage children to be open-minded, embrace change, and see challenges as an opportunity to change.
And open-minded means different things to different people. And
yes.
That has to do with memes, which we'll be talking about later.
Right. We need to be positive with kids so that they understand that it allows them to overcome setbacks. If you have negative thoughts all the time saying, I can't do it, you're not going to be able to do it. But isn't it Thomas the Train that says, I can, going up the hill? Those stories have positive impact for children.
No, that was the little engine that could.
Oh, that's right, the little engine that could, sorry. but it gives them the positive outlook to try and that they can. The challenge, they can meet that challenge.
Yeah, they need. It's hard as a parent to kind of not overprotect your kids. I can remember I was afraid that you know, all the horrible things that could happen to my little girls. So when they were pretty young, I knew that I had to let them experience the wide world by themselves, or at least, and this is very important, believe that they were. So I was helicoptering, but I was helicoptering from a place where they didn't know I was helicoptering, and they walked a few blocks down to the store, and they just thought they were all that. But I was behind the bushes watching their first experience.
And it's okay to fail. They need to learn that. They need to learn from it and to pick themselves up and start over again from that failure. So failure teaches you something to keep trying. And this is positive for kids. And kids should be reprimanded in a positive manner. You don't tell them they're stupid. You don't come down on them totally negative. I always think of the comment to a child, you're better than that. And they know exactly what you're talking about.
And unless you're a pre-programmed robot, you do not succeed until you fail. They have to fail, because if they're not allowed to fail, they go out into a world where they're guaranteed to fail some of the time, and it'll be traumatic rather than just a little bump in the road.
And when something happens to them at school, I know kids get real sensitive about maybe a grade or what someone said to them. Remind them that a month from now, this event may not mean anything to them, that it will be part of the memory. Yesterday, today was tomorrow. Yeah, when we spoke yesterday of the next day, we called it tomorrow. And the one in the past was called yesterday. So remind them that in just a short amount of time, that will be history.
Right. And truly, sounds like a philosophical statement, but tomorrow really does never arrive, because when it does, it's today.
That's right. And today is always yesterday, but on the next day.
Yeah. So it really, there's just the now. And I think we have these suicides where kids are, you know, dissed on the internet and so on. And I think we're just raising our kids to be too protected. I remember way back in the 50s when my older sister, my mother was apparently keeping her too clean and too far away from dirt, and she was getting all sorts of allergies. And back then, our wise old doctor said, you need to take her out and put her in the dirt.
Yes.
And, you know, I have that feeling today. You can hide from things that you're a little bit allergic to, and then pretty soon you're violently allergic to them. And that's the same thing with drama and strife in our lives. You got to be exposed to it.
And I remember the saying as a kid, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Those were ways of getting over these things that kids say to one another.
And it's true. The words are harmless unless they're at so many decibels they break your eardrums or something. They're completely harmless. It's how you receive the words and let them influence you that matters.
And kids need tools to deal with their emotions, frustrations, and stress. When my grandson was little, he had a lot of fears and anxieties. And when he was overstimulated, this seemed to be more pronounced. So I'd go tell him to close his eyes, to pretend to be sitting under a tree in a quiet space that he felt peaceful, and take three deep breaths, counting to 10 each time. And when he opened his eyes, he would be calm. And he was. And he learned that as a tool. And recently he told me he still does that. And it's been many, many years since then.
And what's on my face is not a smirk. It's a smile, because I remember my one daughter, who is now a certified insanity trainer, among other things, and is very active in nature. I remember telling her that once. You know, just take a few deep breaths and meditate. And her answer was, yeah, Dad, there, I'm done.
No, deep counting to 10, inhale, counting to 10, exhale. That's not deep breaths going like that.
That was her version of it, of shutting me up.
Yes. I have a coworker who has a 5-year-old son with behavior issues. And his therapist has told him to close his eyes and find that guy that is telling him to kick and hit people and squirting with whipped cream until he runs away or he dissolves. And that has worked as a tool for this little guy. That's what we need to do, is give them these little tools to help them deal with these frustrations. They don't know why they're being overcome by this emotion, and this helps them deal with it.
And remember that you're dealing with individuals, and so specific examples won't work with every person. You have to know your audience. You have to know your child, and that's part of good parenting. And knowing what you can, I watch my youngest daughter with her little kids. She comes up with very creative ways to try to get them to, you know, to believe a certain way or to get over something that's really stressing them out. Her daughter's a drama queen at a very young age, and she's learning because she talks to them in a way they can understand.
And reading stories to your kids about characters that overcome setbacks or obstacles, problem solving, how to make big choices, kids in, you know, stories about books, and it can be about frogs, or it doesn't have to be about little kids. The story can be about frogs or anything else where challenges are overcome.
And those of you that have little boys, find the original Pinocchio story. It's a wonderful story about the evolution of a boy who really can't call himself a boy. I mean, symbolically, it's because he doesn't know how to be human yet. And you know, he becomes human through his own actions, through strife. We want to protect our kids from everything today. And, you know, the movies that we enjoy the most, Hollywood, some of the people in Hollywood are the first ones to say that we need to take care of everybody and protect all of us from ourselves and all of that. And yet, look at the movies that make them the money. Those are movies where somebody overcomes stressor after stressor after situation after intractable problems and succeed, and yet they're among the first that say we need to guarantee everybody an income, guarantee everybody food, guarantee everybody shelter. And yet their movies say the opposite, and the movies, they don't make the other movies because nobody would watch them because they're not, they don't make you feel good about yourself. Overcoming things makes you feel good about yourself.
The Disney movies, kids love them because the characters triumph against overcoming incredible odds. This How to Train Your Dragon is an example that's very similar to Cinderella type of idea or whatever. It doesn't matter if it's male or female, but it goes back to the story itself where people help play together or work together to overcome odds. And it's often parent, child, or another relative and a child. Sometimes it's children together. But it also teaches them interaction, to work together. These movies are not just strictly entertainment. They are teaching kids something.
Well, but movies about adults. I mean, we want to protect people from the evil corporate monster that's going to take things away from us. So we want to create all these laws that somehow are supposed to do that. And yet, the movies that make us all feel good about ourselves and about the protagonist are the ones where they do the overcoming on their own. And someone's not protecting them all the time from everything.
And I remember back as a kid, a lot of the movies would have this message about good prevails over evil. All the good cowboys had white hats and the bad cowboys had black hats. It might have been overkill, I don't know, but it gave us a real perspective of dealing with good and bad and how usually good triumphs over evil. It wasn't until that awful movie, Train to Yuma, 410 Train to Yuma, where the bad guy wins. I thought that was a terrible movie.
Well, I think I kind of disagree in a sense. I think the movies today, they're making great movies today, and they show that good people don't always win, but they show it in a way that says that's no reason for you to give up. And so I think it's good that they show real life, because when those movies you talked about, I agree, they gave us a good, easy picture of what's right and what's wrong, but you watch those movies, and then the real world slaps you in the face when that guy just seems to make it no matter what he does. Everybody seems to like him. I think it's better that you grow up knowing how to deal with him, but you know that you can deal with him or her, and that you have to make that happen, that no one can make that happen for you.
Well, it goes back to the idea that you have in your mindset that you are going to address it. You're not going to run from it. The mindset of victimization is a very negative, polarizing you from society effect.
And you find a solution, and you find a realistic solution, and you fight for that. And it's the battle that matters. The outcome is important, but not as important as the battle that gets you there, because the battle is what makes you who you are. The outcome is kind of a demonstration of what you've accomplished so far, But who you are goes on to the future and fights other battles. And every battle defines you.
And accomplishment, it's a horrific reward of accomplishment. And that can be as minor as, you know, learning to ride a bicycle to something major. But it is rewarding in and to itself. It's just like volunteering. It's an unspoken gift that you give. You can't really identify it because it touches you in ways that are not necessarily tangible.
And I think they're all battles are the same size. It just depends on who you are at the time of the battle. That riding the bike thing is a big deal. The first time your dad lets go or your mom lets go and you're riding that bike by yourself, that's as big as winning a world war. I mean, that's big for someone that size and with that limited experience. And that's what matters is those battles. We are not letting kids or adults fight their own battles anymore. We're trying to protect everybody. And that's not what makes us the kind of people that we are. We're going to take a little... go ahead.
I was just going to say, I recently saw something on... And where they did a little clip where a dad was training his daughter on how to ride a bike, and he was holding on to the back of her seat, and mom was filming it, and he kept walking by her, but he let go of the seat. And then just before she stopped, he held on to the seat again and said, "See, it's much easier than you think." And then they took her in and showed her the video, and she realized that she was doing it without him holding on to the bike.
I used to do that to my girls with certain things, and I would say, "You've been doing it this way for 5 minutes. You just didn't know it."
Yes.
It's important for them because then it kind of solidifies itself. A real quick short story about my over-helicoptering at certain times when my daughter was riding her bicycle in the street for the first time, and I was frantic that she always be looking all around her to avoid all traffic at all times. And she was so good at that, she ran into a parked car in front of her because she was trying to do what I was telling her to do. And I just realized you need to back off a little bit because I fell off a bike 1,000 times. But what I was going to get to is that we're going to move to this concept of memes because it's a big part of our minds, and we don't... memes is a new science of memetics, and it has to do with a book by Richard Brody called Virus of the Mind. And mind viruses have already infected governments, educational systems, and inner cities, leading to some of the most pervasive and troublesome problems of society today, Richard says. Youth gangs, the welfare cycle, the deterioration of the public schools, and ever-growing government bureaucracy. Virus of the mind has to do with people joining this kind of gang think, taking an attitude or opinion that is based on nothing in reality. It's just something that's kind of infected your mind, and you're only going to pay attention to information that supports it.
Memes, by the way, it's memes, M-E-M-E-S. They're a form of indoctrination and a social herd mentality that is detrimental to society. And if you remember back, your parents told you you'll do things in a pack that you would never do on your own and to be careful of that. And now society has bought into this whole theory of memes. And it can be as crazy as their opinion about Dancing with the Stars. It can be any kind of social activity that is perpetuated by the internet. There was a recent show, I think it was called CSI Cyber or something, but they talked about how society was manipulated by an incident that never occurred. They thought that this guy had been killed when, in fact, at the end of the show, he stands up and he goes, "I'm fine." But it was the meme mentality of the socialization of society by the internet.
Right. And people have memes in politics. Politics is really strong that way. But superstitions are memes. You know, you see these sports players that have to do these certain things, and you call it habits. But there's a part of their brain that believes if they don't do it, they're not going to make the right pitch.
And speaking of the political meme, if you're, you know, conditioned to only believe what Rush Limbaugh or Tom Hartman or any other of these political leaders talk about, you're creating a meme. And this has become destructive to our political system within our country. We can't get anything accomplished. We can't solve any problems because we're divided along these lines that appear to be political, but in reality, they're memes.
And I want to make it clear, at least for myself, that listening to either one of these two is not the problem.
No.
The problem is that you just believe what they say. And you don't question anything they say because they're part of the group that has your meme, and so you're just going to believe anything they say. And I frankly get tired of hearing the two sides just call each other names now. Essentially, that's what they're doing. Neither one is using common sense anymore.
Well, we need to solve the problems of our society and our the world issues that are at our doorstep. And we're not even talking about them because we're all preoccupied with accusing each other and calling each other names. And it doesn't accomplish anything. Listen to these people, but also let in other points of view so that you can make a rational decision and think logically about what they're saying and discount some of it and embrace other parts of it.
When I go to online blogs to talk about politics or some philosophical subject or something, I like to go places where they disagree with me so that I can try to influence people or listen to a different point of view. And often enough, I go there and I make a comment and what I get is just personal attacks. But the thing is, they sticks and stones. So just continue to make your logical argument and say, well, that was wonderful, but it didn't say anything about what I said. It just talked about me. Do you have anything else to say? And go places where you're not all agreeing. You go to these political blogs, and it's all just people telling each other how wonderfully right they are. How does that accomplish anything intellectual?
Right. And one of the things that you had talked about to me about attitude was that we separate it from behavior. So despite we might have psychologists have found that attitudes and behavior are not always perfectly aligned. And a good example of this is people who support a political party or campaign, they never go out and vote. Yet they seem to tie onto this or meme it, if you might use that as an expression.
Well, part of a study about attitude and a psychological definition of attitude is that researchers discovered that people are more likely to behave according to their attitudes under certain conditions. And again, the key phrase there is more likely. This isn't a black or white thing. When your attitudes are the result of personal experience, and see, that's not a meme. A meme is what you could develop out of personal experience. When you're an expert in the subject, your attitude is likely to be more professional. When you expect a favorable outcome, that will affect your behavior towards the attitude. And when the attitudes are repeatedly expressed, you're more likely to continue to express it. We talked about that earlier off the program about exercise. And when you stand, the more you stand to win or lose something due to this issue, you're more likely to express your attitude. Because attitude is an internal thing. It's your evaluation of something. It's not always your actions. It depends on how strong your attitude is and what are the benefits of acting out your attitude at the particular moment. So attitude is internal.
And social roles and norms can have a strong influence on your attitude and your association with something. If it's a positive association, your attitude will more likely be positive towards that. If it's a negative association, then it's more likely to be negative. And that's where we talked earlier about your thought patterns. If you think in a negative way about a specific person, chances are you're over time going to develop a negative response from that person.
That's right. And their response will be based upon how their attitude has changed from allowing you to change their attitude. It all gets kind of complicated, but attitudes can be changed. And that's one of the messages we want to have tonight is that everyone has an attitude and a multiplicity of attitudes. It depends on what it is you're talking about. You have a political attitude. You have a personal attitude. You have an attitude about Wisconsin. You have a different attitude about California. Attitudes are ubiquitous. The question is, any particular attitude, is it a healthy one? And if it isn't, if you've examined it and it's not healthy, then you want to change it, and you can change it.
An attitude is a conscious choice of the way you're thinking about something. And in order to change your subconscious, you need to stop using negative thought and redirect them to a positive thought. That's the only way you can diminish the pathway in your brain and let the new pathway be developed to positive thought. They call it focused attention, and to develop this type of, what do we call it, brain rewiring. The function or practice of joy, kindness, and forgiveness takes a positive focus to develop, but it will do new mapping in your brain to create positive memories or positive pathways.
But it it does take work, because you need to have a basis for why something has a positive nature to you. It can't just be saying, I'm going to think positive about it. You have to examine the issue and decide why it's positive. And once you've done that, your brain can take over, and because you've now qualified it and said, well, I don't even know why I'm thinking negatively about this. It's a positive thing.
Right. And there was a study done, or a book out, called The Mind and the Brain by Jeffrey Schwartz and Sharon Begley. And they state, and is a good example of this, anger shuts down communication to the prefrontal cortex of the brain. Thus, fear and emotion dominate and determine our behavior. You lose the ability to be rational and the awareness that you're being irrational. So you can shut yourself down by these extreme emotions.
And memes do that as well.
And you need to step back and examine, why am I so out of control? Why am I so angry? What is it that has triggered that? And that's when you need to take that focused attention and redirect that thought. I'm not going to react to that again this way next time. And it will minimize the impact on you over time. It's not going to change in 1 or 2 days. This is focused attention. It's repeat behavior that you're going to have to create new pathways in the brain to look at things and respond to them differently. This is your perspective. This is who you are and who you can change within yourself.
Avoid groupthink. Groupthink makes no sense to me at all. Most of the people that get angry with me at political comments, it's the groupthink thing. All I'm asking someone to do in most of these situations is give me a logical argument against what I'm saying, and instead all I get is attacks. When I get those, that's groupthink. Just think for yourself, examine all of the issues, examine the logic of what your argument or your feeling is about anything. I mean, you can be logical about love, because there are things that you can think about with someone you care about, and you can be logical about it with yourself and say, does it make any sense for me to feel this angry? That's a logical thought which can be applied to a situation that has to do with love and romance.
It also goes back to the kids. Am I overreacting to something a child did because of what happened to me in the last 3 hours at work?
Or 50 years ago.
Or the traffic. You know, I am angry because I got cut off in traffic, or I'm 10 minutes late for an appointment and I'm taking it out on this child. Think about, why am I so angry? Angry is one of the most detrimental negative emotions we have.
It's amazing what cars do to people. Did that happen with horses, I wonder?
Oh, I'm sure it did. And then it was mud or something worse that would get on people. I'm sure they had the same thing. It just may not have been as intense.
People get so violently intense on the road. Even if just someone is driving the speed limit in front of them, they just go crazy.
Well, fear is the original flight. What do they call it? Fear or flight? Solution to everything.
Yeah.
And it is very intense. It's ingrained in us.
It was great in the jungle, but it's not such a good idea now. Use caution, not fear. We're going to be talking about some of these things over the next few programs. I hope we've been somewhat helpful tonight. We really appreciate whoever our listeners out there. And if you would email us or call and say what you like or don't like about us, we would know who you are and what your opinions are. Our email is examinelife@kkrn.org. And you are listening to KKRN 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain. And we are a publicly supported a listener-supported radio station, and you need to contribute to this station if you're listening to it, and be part of the solution.
And smile. Give it away. It's free, and it always makes someone else feel good, and you can't be angry if you're smiling.
That's right.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are of the speakers and do not reflect the views and opinions of the radio station, KKRN, its management, staff, or underwriters.
And we'll talk to you next time.
Good night.
Programming on KKRN is supported in part by listeners like you and Mountain Valley's health centers, serving the Intermountain communities by providing primary care.